Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other things that circulate this time of year. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
And a very happy new year to you. It's the first time we've been on live together in 2025. I hope your holidays went well.
Thank you. Happy new year to you, too.
We don't have good news to start with. Let's start with the news we do. A troubling report of a case of bird flu in Louisiana. Most of the cases in people to date have been very mild. These have been people who work with cattle and apparently are infected by the strain that's been moving through cattle herds. This is a person with the strain that hospitalized a teenager in Canada. It's called D1.1, who has also been hospitalized with avian influenza. Help us understand this news development. This strain, as far as we understand, is only moving through birds right now?
Right. This is a bird strain. It's important to remember that influenza is what we call a zoonotic disease, or a disease in animals. And the animal of choice for influenza, its reservoir, is our birds. And this strain that you're mentioning, that the teenager in British Columbia and this man in Louisiana contracted, is from birds. It's not the strain that we're seeing from dairy cattle. We don't know how either of these people got infected, although there's some evidence of contact with backyard birds, but it's not completely clear. What is clear, and what is very disturbing, as you mentioned, Brian, is that this man in Louisiana, like the teenager in British Columbia, both became very, very ill. Fortunately, it looks like both are going to survive, although we don't have as much information about the man in Louisiana. So two very sick people with bird flu, and typically bird flu, and that is from birds. So raises a big alarm. And when we've looked at the genetics of this virus, it appears in the man in Louisiana to have changed probably while being infected, although that's not clear yet. In the teenager in British Columbia, it appears pretty clear that the virus that infected her and then evolved in her did change. And these changes that we've seen in both patients suggest that the organism is evolving to make it easier for it to infect human beings. Now, all of this is very preliminary. Neither of these people have infected other people around them, which is a big plus, but it's a disturbing change in these two respects. One, that they got sick, very sick, and two, that the virus appears to be evolving towards being more what we call humanized.
We should probably draw a bright line under the fact that these are severe cases. The teenager in British Columbia, according to a case study written up in the New England Journal of Medicine, required 3 antiviral medications, plasma exchange, temporary support to the heart and lungs. The teenager had to be hooked up to a machine that oxygenated their blood for them, and were intubated for 3 weeks, not breathing on their own. That's like both horrifying for that person, but you can imagine how swiftly our medical care system would come crashing down if a significant number of people required that kind of care at the same time.
Sure. That's where the concern is, of course. There have been close to 50 cases of bird flu. Most of these have been contracted from the strain in dairy cattle. And besides these two cases that we're talking about, none of these cases have been significant. Conjunctivitis, a few people have had a little bit of fever, but nobody's been really sick from it. So these two cases really do stand out.
So what is the scenario in which this strain, the strain that causes more severe illness, becomes better adapted to spread in people? Is it just the more people get infected by birds, the more chances the virus has to adapt to human bodies? Or are we worried about recombination, someone getting infected with two strains at the same time that swap DNA?
Yeah, well, we're really worried about both. We're worried about the ability of the virus to evolve it's by itself to become more humanized. That is, being able to infect human beings with greater facility and therefore transfer person to person. But we're very worried, particularly this time of the year, with humanized strains of influenza now taking a big upturn, that this virus could infect somebody who already has a humanized form, and the two could recombine. And we could have a bird flu virus that has a lot of the features of a humanized virus suddenly. So that's really where the worry is. But I think it's important to pause and take a step back and put this in perspective. The bird flu has been around for around three decades that we've documented. And there have been outbreaks in people before. But it's never to date figured out how to use Homo sapiens as its victim, if you will, of choice to allow it to replicate and spread. So we do have 30 years of experience with this organism not exploding, but that doesn't, of course, tell us anything about what the future is going to bring.
Speaking of Dr. John Swartzberg, clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health, he is here to answer your questions about COVID, avian influenza, and the other things that go around this time of year. 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. 1-800-958-9008. I have a big pileup of questions from the inbox because of our holiday pause. The first is on this topic. It comes from Diane, who did not mention what city she's in. She writes, in view of the danger of avian influenza, what should someone do if they find a dead bird? How should we clean up bird excrement, say, from our windshields?
Well, that's a great question. And I think the reasonable answer to this is be very careful. If you have to pick up the dead bird, be sure you're wearing gloves. Be sure you put the bird immediately into some container, like a plastic container that's not going to leak air. Tighten it very well. Call animal control if you've got a dead bird in the backyard. Ask them what you should be doing with it. In terms of cleaning bird feces from the from your windows, again, just make sure you don't have hand contact with that, which I don't think anybody would want to have anyway. The virus is quite susceptible to alcohol, to bleach, so it's easy to clean up from that perspective.
It is, however, present in feces, right? There was a big spread in the New York Times over the weekend saying one of the kind of premier monitoring programs for watching what strains of influenza are moving in the wild involves scraping bird poop off a beach in New Jersey.
Right. It's present in all the, to the best of my knowledge, in all of the excretions from birds. And certainly we've seen this in humans as well with the virus infecting people. We think of influenza as a respiratory infection, but the virus can be shed in the stool as well. And of course, we've had that very interesting and surprising observation almost a year ago now, that the virus can shed in the udders of cows, but leaving very high concentrations of the virus in raw milk.
All right. Let's go to our first caller. John is on the line in El Sobrante. Good morning.
Good morning. I am 72 with a type of leukemia, so I'm in the high group. I had my COVID shot last on 9/11, September 11th, and I wanted to get another shot. There's nothing with Kaiser online nor my doctor knowing anything about when I can get my next shot when it's authorized. I think the government has done nothing. It'll be 4 months come January 11th, so I'm wondering what I should do.
Sure, John.
Dr. Schwartzberg.
Yeah, thanks, John, for your question. The CDC spells this out pretty clearly. For people over the age of 65 and other people at higher risk of having a bad outcome from COVID, the recommendation would be roughly about 6 months after your last shot. But in people who are severely immunocompromised, that is at the really highest risk of having a bad outcome if you get COVID, those people can get the vaccine up to every 2 months if necessary. This is a decision and a discussion you need with your physician. If you're at Kaiser, you would talk to your doctor there or talk to your physician, whoever is caring for you, and talk to them about how severely immunocompromised you are. Having leukemia by in and of itself may not make you that severely immunocompromised, but it may. And it may depend upon what medications you're taking to control the disease. So if you're in the very severe category, you could get it as frequently as every 2 months. That would be very frequent and may not be necessary. But again, this really merits a careful discussion with your physician.
So Dr. Schwartzberg, John said he's already had like a fruitless interaction with his doctor. So maybe we should tell him like what page of the CDC's website to point that doctor at. What I just pulled up is Interim Clinical Considerations for Use of COVID-19 Vaccines in the United States, updated on Halloween of 2024.
That's it.
Okay. We'll put that in the show notes in the archive at kpfa.org, John, in case it's helpful. 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. Again, that's 1-800-958-9008. Next question from the inbox comes from Richard in San Francisco. He writes, please ask Dr. Schwartzberg about the apparently surging norovirus cases in the Bay Area. In my senior building, there have been 7 cases in the last few days. How long should an afflicted person exercise caution after they recover from the symptoms?
Yeah, norovirus has really wreaked its ugly head up. We have outbreaks of norovirus every winter. So it's right on schedule. But what's unusual this year is we're seeing an awful lot of cases of norovirus, many more than we've seen in the last quite a few years. And the explanation for that is not entirely clear. Perhaps some of this has to do with the COVID pandemic and not as many people getting infected with it over those 5 years. And so we have a larger pool of susceptible people. I haven't seen any reports yet of norovirus changing genetically to make it more infective. So we'll await to see if there's anything more about that. But we are seeing an awful lot of norovirus, not just here in the Bay Area, but we're seeing it throughout the United States. Big outbreak. And it's not something anybody wants to get. It makes you pretty miserable for a day or two or three sometimes.
This is severe gastrointestinal symptoms, right?
Right. Nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. Typically not with fever. And so you're not systemically that ill, but you're just absolutely miserable. A lot of people call it the winter vomiting disease. So it's really quite bothersome. We've known about norovirus for a long time. Many of the listeners will remember that we've been seeing for quite a long time outbreaks on ships, any place where you have a lot of people living together. So ships have been notorious for outbreaks. What's been difficult to control norovirus is that it's really hardy outside of us. You know, we've been talking a lot about COVID, influenza, RSV. These are respiratory viruses that are not really hardy outside of us. And it's easy to kill with soap and water or just alcohol. So norovirus is not like that. It's the alcohol that we carry with us to cleanse our hands when we don't have access to soap and water is not very effective at all in killing norovirus. So it's easy to spread that way. What does get rid of it is soap and water. The soap doesn't necessarily kill it, but what it does is when you're washing your hands with soap and water, the virus goes down the drain as opposed to staying on your hands. So that's the way you have to cleanse your hands with this virus. There may be other ways it can spread, like if somebody's vomiting at a table and can aerosolize it and you could inhale that. But the primary way is getting it on your hands and then contaminating yourself with that. In terms of how long you're contagious, go ahead.
I hope everyone's enjoying their breakfast right now. Sorry, Dr. Schwartz, but go ahead.
I'm sorry. The type of, in terms of prolonged contagion, I don't have that number right in front of me right now, but unfortunately, people who have norovirus can shed the virus for a while. So it would be important to just check the CDC site for how long one is contagious with this.
And again, you're going to worry about surfaces that person has possibly infected well after they recover as well, not just the person who had the illness.
Right. Think of norovirus as a virus that can live outside of the human being for a while, so it's much hardier.
All right. Hope that's helpful, Richard. Let's go back to the phone lines and take a call from out of town. Jean is on the line from Silver Spring, Maryland. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to ask what you thought of using hypochlorous acid for cleaning surfaces. I just came across something, and I just wanted to find out if you might know more about it than I do, and I'll hang up.
Sure. It is very bactericidal and virucidal, meaning it kills viruses, bacteria, other life forms like fungi and protozoa. It kills very well. It's also probably not necessary to use on any kind of regular basis. It's really, if you will, overkill. But there may be certain circumstances where you would want to do that. So yes, it's very good on for environmental objects. The caution would be that it can really be damaging to a lot of material that it's put on. So you'd have to be careful in that respect. But it is an effective way of killing microorganisms. Again, Brian and I are always talking about these terrible infections, but it's important to remember that we don't really need, and we don't want to, quote, sterilize or nearly sterilize our environment. That's not good for us either. So any kind of cleaning solution is usually effective, with the exception of, again, selected circumstances. For example, if somebody's got norovirus in your home, you're going to want to be more careful, and you're going to want to use an agent, of which there are quite a few, that can kill the virus on inanimate objects.
All right. Hope that's helpful. Closer to home, Rose is on the line in El Cerrito. Good morning, Rose.
Yes, good morning. I have a situation similar to the gentleman who called in earlier. I'm 80, and I have had lung cancer, and I have emphysema, and I'm really compromised that way. And my clinic, which was a federally funded clinic, sent us an announcement that they're with all of that stuff that you told the guy to talk to his doctor about, and they said we could get vaccinations and all that stuff. And when I called them to find out when I could come in, they said they didn't know anything about it. They claimed they didn't. They only had, and then somebody went and checked, and they said, oh, it's only for children who are immune compromised or something. And this is, let me just use initials. That is BS. And they know it. And what's going on? Why isn't that stuff, money being made available in those shots? What can we do? We can't talk to the doctor because they don't know, or if they know, they're not saying something goofy.
Yeah. Thank you for that question, Rose. I don't think there's any kind of sinister plan out there to not make the vaccine available to people who need it. I think it's really a lack of information that unfortunately a lot of health professionals have. Brian said he was going to post the CDC site. You should probably copy that, bring it to your doctor and show he or she what the recommendations are. It's interesting when you read that site, it does say there, when you go to a pharmacy and you tell them you're immunocompromised, the CDC specifically says the pharmacy cannot ask you how immunocompromised are you, or what is the cause of you being immunocompromised. Just saying you are immunocompromised is sufficient. And if you are, then you can get the vaccine at an accelerated schedule. So I think that you should copy that site from the CDC and take it into your physician and show them that and have them order the vaccine.
Maybe print a copy before January 20th, too. We don't know what the CDC website is going to be saying in a few months. All right. Looks like we have time to squeeze in one more caller. Matt is on the line in Burlingame. Good morning, Matt.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, just a quick question. I know just enough immunology to get me into trouble, but it's sure a fascinating subject. Yeah, you know, most of the studies I've read about how often we need a COVID vaccine relate to waning antibody protection. But so I haven't seen any studies on the role of memory T cells. And isn't that their job? And wouldn't that influence the data and the decision making?
Great question, Matt. Yes, immunology is fascinating. It's sort of like we study the things that are easily available to study. And it's very easy to study antibody levels in people's blood and correlate that with protection. It's much more difficult to study T cell activity, and we don't have as much data about that. That said, we do have data, and the data does suggest that T cell activity really lasts a lot longer in terms of giving us protection against COVID and probably other respiratory viruses like RSV and influenza. So right now, the best data that we have is with antibodies, but we do know that T cell activity is very important in curing us from viral infections, and that we do have longer immunity from that than from antibodies.
And this is the best mechanical explanation we have for why people have temporary protection against infection after vaccination, but seem to have more enduring protection against getting severely ill, like requiring hospitalization. The
That's
antibodies
right.
wane, the T cells last longer.
Exactly. You get COVID. If you get vaccinated the first month, maybe 2 months, it's very unlikely you're going to get COVID. After that, the protection against getting infected is not very great, but the protection against getting really sick from it is considerable, and that lasts much longer.
Dr. Swartzberg, in the limited data we have, do we have any sense of what the decline curve, the process of waning, looks like for T cell levels?
Well, there have been studies that have suggested that we have protection from T cells well beyond a year. And some studies have even suggested longer than that now. So the bottom line is we really don't know in a large population how effective that is. And we certainly don't know for the particular individual. And that's one of the reasons we do advise more frequent vaccinations for people who are severely immunocompromised. So right now, again, the best tool we have are the antibodies in terms of protection. But I think as more time passes and we get more data, we're going to have a much better handle on your question, Brian.
All right. Dr. Swartzberg, we'll leave it there for this week. Thank you so much for making yourself available to us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.